As I'm sitting here right now, I am so glad that I live in this day and age, because before Pentecost, before the spiritual global warming of the Spirit in the world, right after the death of Christ, there was evil that lurked in the world, and it was big, and it was bold, and it was almost unhindered. I'm glad I'm here today.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
So I think the question that's on the table today, Jack, is what is being filled with the Spirit and how is that different from speaking in tongues? How do those two interact, or are they similar? Are they different? Educate us, okay?
Okay. And the controversy, I assume, behind the question is the controversy between a Pentecostal theology that argues that being filled with the Spirit is normally and routinely accompanied by speaking in tongues, whereas there is other theology that argues that that's not the case. I assume that's the controversy behind the question.
It is. And something I remember saying at the end of our last program was, if being filled with the Spirit means that we speak in tongues, why also then doesn't it mean that we have flames of fire coming out of our heads and that there aren't whooshes of wind coming into the room like there were on the day of Pentecost? Why have we chosen only speaking in tongues as evidence of the Spirit in our lives? That's a very curious thing to me.
Yeah, and that's a very good observation. Maybe we can come back to that and explore that at length if we have time, because it is curious. It's very curious that we would build a theology around one of the signs of Pentecost, but not all of them. That in of itself is a very interesting conversation, I think. But in terms of the controversy itself, as we look at the book of Acts, we do see the coming of the Spirit being poured out on this room of Jewish believers, and these manifestations, these miraculous manifestations, one of them being the ability to speak a language that they didn't know, that wasn't their native language. Is it reasonable to conclude, well, I guess when people have the Spirit poured out, that God intends for them normally to speak in tongues? I mean, is that a reasonable understanding? Yes, it is. I mean, there's, on the surface, on the face of it, there's really no reason why that's a foolish interpretation. That's one way to look at it. But what I would argue is that that interpretation fails to have a deep understanding of God's purposes and what he's doing. And for that matter, it fails to have a deep understanding of what the book of Acts is and what it's doing and what it's describing.
So like you said, if we look at that and isolate it, speaking in tongues, what we've done is maybe not looked at the richness of that book and really understood it as fully as we could.
Right.
And gleaned from it as much as we could.
Right, exactly.
So in a sense, we could be missing out.
Right. Missing out and ultimately distorting what the book is saying, and which is what I would argue, that we have distorted what the book is actually saying. And, you know, innocently enough, I mean, we've just simply given it our best shot to understand what the correlation is between speaking in tongues and being filled with the Spirit. But because we've lacked a deep enough understanding of Acts, we've got it wrong. We've missed it.
Now, Jack, that's not a very popular stance that you're taking. And I think people could say, now, why do you, Jack Crabtree, go against the the common belief here of many, many people in the church? Is it just based on, boy, you don't want to believe that, or because of some personal reason, or have you done much research in a broad way?
Well, I would say that I've spent the last, probably 30 years now of my life studying primarily the New Testament and the Old Testament to the extent that I need to understand the New Testament. And so I hope that I've done broad research and that I'm coming to understand what is going on in the New Testament, and it's out of that perspective that I come to this conclusion.
And you've been willing to look at both sides of the coin, not just try and prove your own side?
Well, I think so, yeah. I mean, there's always, one is never completely certain that they have set their prejudices aside, so could I be prejudiced against it? Yeah, that's possible. But that's what everyone will have to decide for themselves and make a judgment on that. Does my perspective really hold up? Does it really make sense? Does it really make the most sense out of the biblical data or not? If it doesn't, then maybe some prejudices are at work in my thinking.
And I think from knowing you, I think you really are giving an invitation. Boy, if you guys don't agree with what I'm saying, please
reject what I'm saying at the very least.
Think about it. Keep studying it. You don't have to buy it,
sure,
but
absolutely.
Take this on as part of what you're thinking about and bring it further.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
I don't pretend to be infallible at all. The key for me, and I had been kind of edging up to this perspective for many, many years, but it wasn't until my most recent study of the Book of Acts that it, you know, kind of hit me with full force exactly what I think is going on here. In the past programs, we've talked about some of this, but I haven't really developed it in full. The key, it seems to me, is to understand that the Day of Pentecost was a watershed event. I mean, I underline that and emphasize that as much as I can. A real turning point in the history of, in cosmic history, really, but certainly in the history of the world, the history of the human race. It was a real turning point. It's the beginning. It's the inauguration of a whole new era. What name would we give to that era? Well, the name that Paul gives to that era in the book of Romans is the time of the Gentiles, which is interesting that the time of the Gentiles would be inaugurated with a bunch of Jews receiving these supernatural signs, but maybe that'll make sense as I paint the picture here. Some people argue, some theological traditions have argued that we are seeing the Spirit in the world for the first time at the Day of Pentecost. That doesn't make any sense to me for a variety of reasons, but most importantly because the role of the Spirit is, as we have discussed in past programs, as the Spirit of Truth, is the activity of God coming into my life to give me eyes to see, ears to hear, to bring clarity of understanding to my mind and my knowledge of who God is and what He's up to in the world.
To kind of take out the scales of my own blindness.
Yes. To remove the scales so that I can see and see dramatically and clearly what my life and existence is all about and live accordingly. That's the role of the Spirit. It's, you know, probably months ago we talked about sanctification, but it's the Spirit who sanctifies us. It's the Spirit who brings holiness into my life by removing my resistance, my hostility to God, by removing that, erasing that, getting that out of the way, so that I can do what ought to be done, value what ought to be valued, live the way I ought to live. That's the role of the Spirit in my life. Not primarily to give me power over nature or over my circumstances or even over my own will. Not primarily that kind of power, but the power that comes from a clear understanding of reality. That's the fundamental role of the Spirit. And quite reasonable understanding is that that has always been the case. Anytime any person has ever really become a man or woman who loves God and knows God, why did they become that kind of person rather than not? Because God has poured His Spirit out into them, or has sent His Spirit to them to change their heart, to write His law on their heart, to teach them to love Him, to teach them to know God. So a person like Moses, or a person like Abraham, or a person like David, or a person like Joseph, if you look at all the people that are held up in the Old Testament as men or women who loved God, who knew God, who followed God, who obeyed God, who trusted God, why are they those kinds of people if not for the Spirit of God? So it makes no sense, given the role that the Spirit is described as having, that we are seeing the Spirit for the first time at Pentecost. That doesn't really make any sense at all. So what is happening at Pentecost? What does this mean that the Spirit is being poured out when the Spirit's already been around? You know, what are we talking about? Well, I think I mentioned in the past program that, that the key is to understand what's different now is that we're entering into an era where the scope of the Spirit's activity is magnified many, many times over. That up until the time from the beginning of time until the day of Pentecost were, for the most part, spiritually dark times. It was the people who loved God were few and far between. They really were scattered among the population and stood out like just really unusual and rare people.
Very sparse.
Very sparse.
To a time when, on one day, thousands of people, was it thousands or hundreds?
Yeah, in fact, 3,000, didn't we decide? 3,000 people on the day of Pentecost turned to Jesus.
So that's a huge outpouring in relationship to what had happened in the past.
Right.
He kind of turned up the volume on the Spirit.
Right.
Not that the Spirit didn't exist before, but now he's really making much more of an impact in individual lives.
Right. So I like to look at it as a change in the spiritual ecology, if you will, or spiritual climate. It's a completely different climate that we're going to now enter into. One of the indicators of that occurred to me, and I'm speculating here. There's nothing in the Bible that suggests this, but I remember all my life as a Bible student, it's really been curious to me that the activity of demons in the time of Jesus in particular, but even in the time of the apostles, is very dramatic, it's very pronounced, it's very prevalent, apparently, and there's no confusion about, there doesn't seem to be any confusion about what's going on. When they're confronting a demon, they know they're confronting a demon. When they're confronting the activity of a demon in a person's life, it's clear to them. And Luke makes it clear that he seems to understand the difference between diseases and demonic activity. I mean, it's not like they're these stupid, naive, old people, ancient people who are superstitious and don't know a disease when they see one, and therefore they're attributing all disease to these fanciful, mythical little things called demons, and we're scientific and we know better. That's not a good explanation, because Luke is very clear that he understands the difference between somebody who has an organic problem and somebody who's has some symptom that's a result of demonic activity.
Somehow that was common in their culture.
It was a known.
It
sure seems to be. That's the picture that emerges in both the Gospels and Acts.
I think you're really right in thinking about it. I've been curious about that also. There seems to be a real understanding. We don't seem to have that.
Right. Now, there are people, there are traditions that see lots of demons in our culture today, but those of us who are looking on from the outside, I must confess, I'm sort of skeptical. I've been to two exorcisms in my life, and there are people who are convinced that they were exorcising a demon, and it sure looked to me like it wasn't anything of the sort. One in particular, that this demon would speak in another voice and try, the whole scene was trying to imitate the things that the Bible describes. But when this woman would speak in another voice, it sure sounded to me like she was just altering her voice. And the whole scene suggested to me that this woman, for whatever reasons, whatever motives, conscious or unconscious, known to her or not really acknowledged by her, that this was an attention-getting device by her. There wasn't anything clearly supernatural happening at all. It was just this performance put on to try to give the appearance of a woman who had a demon in her.
Or I think another very viable explanation would be multiplicity.
Yeah, I mean, that was this case. Yes, actual psychoses of one kind or another, or mental disorders of one kind or another that kind of mimic and duplicate the sorts of pictures that we have of demons. Now, we could argue, well, Luke just doesn't have that kind of sophisticated understanding of what the human mind can do. We could argue that, but I really don't think that's the case. I mean, the more I study ancient people, they were intellectually sophisticated people. They were not simple people. Their technology wasn't as flashy as ours, but their spiritual and intellectual life was every bit as sophisticated as ours, and in some cases much more sophisticated than ours. So
we shouldn't be fooled by their lack of technology.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you look at their philosophical works. I don't know a philosopher alive today who can hold a candle to someone like Aristotle or Plato, and they're 300 BC. I mean, this is a long time ago. Because they didn't watch TV and movies and use all their technology, they spent their time thinking. They spent their time understanding, and they developed rich intellectual lives and rich intellectual traditions that were keenly aware of what was real and what was not real, what was true and what was not true. Luke is educated in that culture, and it's just unthinkable that we're dealing with a simpleton who doesn't know the difference between superstition and a viable rational explanation. So for him to call something a demon is not just superstition. He's seeing something that I think I have never experienced. Well, if that's right, if we live in a time where the reason we don't quite know what Luke is talking about is because it doesn't really exist very much anyway, if at all, it just doesn't exist in our experience, then what changed? Well, I think the spiritual climate changed. That there had been a time where spiritual darkness had prevailed, had reigned over human history, and with the coming of Jesus and the coming of the gospel, the light came into the world and has for a time dispelled the darkness. That relatively speaking, and we still live in a dark time, but relatively speaking, it's light by comparison to the darkness that had reigned in the world up until Jesus came into the world. So when John says that Jesus was the light who came into the world and enlightened every man, he means that quite dramatically. I mean, this is not just an empty metaphor. It was a big deal that Jesus came into the world. It literally changed the spiritual climate. Spiritual global warming on a massive scale. And one of the symptoms of that spiritual global warming is the eclipsing of the activity, of the deceiving activity of Satan and demons, so that they just aren't as active. They are not as free to deceive people as they had been before Jesus.
That's quite a visual picture, Jack. Spiritual global warming actually kind of got out of the way some of the demonic activity that was happening and pretty prevalent during that time, and the activity of the Spirit and the light in more men's heart was really taking precedence.
I know this is not a traditional or well or popular interpretation of this passage, but I'm almost convinced, at least, that this passage in Revelation is saying exactly that. It's in chapter 20. One of the visions toward the end of Revelation, it says, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him, so that he would not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time." And as we go on the rest of the chapter, there are problems that get created for this interpretation, and I don't have time to explore them or to solve them. But it does occur to me that scene is describing the age that was inaugurated with Jesus and has extended clear down to the present day and probably will extend into our future until a certain point in time when this time will end. This time of relative spiritual warmth will end, or light will end, and the darkness will descend again as Satan is released from the abyss, like this says, to go out and deceive the nations again.
It's kind of like he's in prison and cannot extend his influence as he has in the past for a short period of time.
Right. Which now, is not to say it's not there at all, but it has been curtailed.
Okay. He's in jail, but it's leaking out.
Yeah, somehow, yeah.
It does say, though, for 1,000 years, Jack, and 1,000 years has passed. 2,000 years has passed since Pentecost. So,
right. The numbers in Revelation seem to be symbolic. They seem to symbolize just broad, sweeping concepts. And 1,000 seems to mean a long time, a long and indeterminate length of time, not literally 1,000, but just
a lot
long
of time.
Enough you don't need to worry about it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that's true of the numbers across the board. They're not literal, but have a symbolic significance. So that's why I suggested that it corresponds with the time of the Gentiles, because if you think about Romans 11, Paul describes the partial hardening that has come over the Jews until the time of the Gentiles is complete. And what Paul envisions in chapter 11 of Romans is Jesus came, the Messiah came, who was the Messiah promised to the Jews. He was their king, the king of the world, the king of kings and king and Lord of Lords, but also uniquely the King of the Jews. But the Jews have never accepted him to this day. Individuals have, but the Jews as a nation have never accepted him as their king. What God did is turn to the Gentiles to open the doors to the kingdom of God primarily and mostly to Gentiles. So the Spirit has mostly been active in the Gentile nations to draw out Gentiles to himself. Never an entire people, never an entire family or tribe, just remnants of Gentiles among all the nations. But he's spent the last 2,000 years drawing out from among the Gentiles people to himself, a remnant of Jews as well, but mostly Gentiles. And so that's why Paul calls this the time of the Gentiles. But he foresees a time when the time of the Gentiles will be complete. Well, what does that mean, except that it sure sounds like what he means by that is the activity of the Spirit of truth in the world acting among the Gentiles is one day going to come to an end. And what that would look like in our experience would be there's going to come a time where Gentiles simply are not receptive any longer to the truth of the gospel. They are hard-hearted, they are stubborn, they are evil, they are perverse, and in their rebellion they will have nothing to do with the light. They are completely and utterly in darkness. And Paul seems to imply very strongly that when that day comes, the reason that will result is because the Spirit of God is going to have shifted his activity from working among Gentiles to work among the Jews. And then God is going to do a remarkable thing, a highly unusual thing. He's no longer simply going to work to bring a remnant of Jews to himself, but he's going to do something unprecedented in all human history. He's going to call a whole generation of Jews to himself, and every last man, woman, and child among this generation of Jews living in that time is going to know God and love God and seek to obey him. No other tribe on the face of the earth will ever have seen that happen in their history, but the Jews alone will have experienced that.
Now, just as an aside, my whole body was just filled with chills with that.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be something to see, Jack?
It'd be amazing. I'd love to see that.
I would love to be around for that. That would be, the most fulfilling, incredible thing to be watching.
Mm-hmm.
What a miracle.
And what an interesting society they will build when it's built on truth and justice and love and mercy and obedience to God and holiness. I mean, what an incredible society that would be.
Amazing.
I mean, not even to be a part of it, but just watch it from the outside would be interesting.
And yet, will they be persecuted as they have in the past?
Well, that actually seems to be the prophetic image at the end, is that all the Gentiles in the nations who are in darkness will, of course, hate them because they are light in the midst of darkness, and darkness always hates light. So the whole battle of Armageddon that is so familiar to us seems to be basically this Gentile world who now hates God thoroughly throughout. I mean, there may always be a remnant of Gentiles, but they will be so overwhelmed by the vast majority of Gentiles who hate God that all of the political leadership and all of the institutions and everything will be arrayed against God. And yet there's this one little spot on the earth in Palestine that still loves God. And nothing but sheer hatred alone, I think, will drive them to want to eradicate them from the earth, to destroy them once and for all. And that's Armageddon, when all the nations of the earth come up against Israel. All the prophets describe it that way. They alternately describe it as Satan going out and deceiving the nations to bring them up against Israel to fight them, or God going into the nations and calling them to fight against Israel. And the prophets describe it as God bringing them up against Israel so that he could finally, once and for all, punish them for their evil, the Gentile nations for their evil. And Armageddon is really basically God's judgment on the nations, because he's going to destroy them and wipe them out. The Gentiles lose that battle.
The Jews finally win.
Yeah, exactly. And it, but in political terms, in cultural terms, sociological terms, why are they coming? What is their motive? I think because they hate Israel, and they hate them because of their righteousness. Just as Cain killed Abel because of Abel's righteousness, the Gentile nations will seek to kill Israel because their deeds are righteous.
So in a sense, all of us will join the Palestinians against the Israel.
Right.
Israelites.
Yes. Right.
Is that the right way to say it?
Yeah, or the Jews, whatever. I don't know what they'll call themselves in those days, but right. It's a mistake to think of Israel today as those people, because as an Orthodox rabbi once said to me about Israel, when I asked him, what do you think of Israel today, he sort of snorted and said, well, they're just a bunch of lapsed Bolsheviks.
What did he mean by that?
Well, that they are basically, it's a basically a socialistic state that is not at all desiring to build their state on holiness. And he agrees with me that the prophetic picture is that the prophets foresee a day when that will change, and the Jews in the land will once again turn back to God and will seek to worship God and serve him in holiness. But he's saying that's not happening now. Mm-hmm. That's not what Israel is today.
Okay.
Okay,
so what we were talking about is the spiritual global warming that happened when the Spirit descended at Pentecost.
Right.
That was unprecedented.
Right. So understanding that that's what's going on, I mean, if we understand that that's what's going on, then it makes sense that the inauguration of that era would happen with the kinds of dramatic signs, supernatural
introductions.
Yeah. That you see at the day of Pentecost, the sound like a mighty roaring wind, the flames of fire dancing over their heads, the speaking in other languages, and anything else that might have happened, it seems utterly appropriate to the occasion. This is a watershed event. This is the day that God has said, we're going to begin shining the light of Christ into the hearts of men by the Spirit of God on this day. At a scale and at a scope that is unprecedented in human history, and it begins now, it begins today. Well, to accompany that with fanfare makes a whole lot of sense. Does that mean that every time the Spirit of, for the rest of history, that every time the Spirit of God enlightens the heart of an individual, all that fanfare will be replicated? No, not necessarily. It makes sense that it wouldn't necessarily be replicated, because only once do you have the beginning of an era, and it's the beginning of the era that you accompany with the fanfare, not the continuation of that era. So that's why it is not at all surprising to me when my eyes were opened and God gave me ears to hear, none of this stuff happened. This was not a part of my awakening and of my personal enlightening. Because it's now become, in a sense, normal, par for the course. This is the way the Spirit has been working in the world for the last 2,000 years. So nothing unusual or dramatic about him doing it one more time in my life. So there doesn't need to be the same fanfare. The fanfare would not be appropriate in the same way as it was on this particular day. So that's fundamentally why I think it's a mistake to argue, to use the reasoning, if God accompanied the reception of the Spirit by these 3,000 people on this day with these supernatural signs, then he better do it in my life today. Well, why? Why better he do it? Don't we understand that this is a watershed event in human history? And that's why the fanfare. Now, the objection that could be raised, that you might be asking, is, well...
Maybe I should be asking and I didn't come up with that question. Is that right, Jack?
Is it's in the book of Acts, it doesn't just happen on Pentecost. It happens a number of different times. And that's what gives credence to the interpretation that it's supposed to happen every time.
You're right. That was the objection I should have had.
But again, if we read the book of Acts carefully, if we come to a deeper understanding of it, I think that the book of Acts gives its own explanation for why God continued to give these miracles. there's a phrase that Luke develops. He talks about some so-and-so proclaiming the gospel to this people, and they received the Spirit, Luke writes. Well, what does he mean by that? How does he know they received the Spirit? There's two things he could mean by that. One is he could simply mean by that that it was evident to us that they really got it, that they really understood, that they really were enlightened, because they were able to turn around and explain it and articulate it, and they really seemed to sincerely and genuinely grasp what the gospel is all about and its implications for their life. That's a very real possibility. But if you look more closely, it appears that at least sometimes, if not all the time that he uses that phrase, he actually also has in mind that something like the flames of fire, the speaking in tongues, the same phenomenon that happened at Pentecost, happened to these people. We know for sure that that's what he means in some instances. For example, when Peter proclaims the gospel to the Roman centurion Cornelius, he says explicitly that they spoke in tongues. And I think he hints, I'm going by memory here, so I might be wrong, but I think he hints that some of the other phenomenon of Pentecost happened as well. That not only did they receive the Spirit, this invisible reality of the Spirit just coming in quietly in their minds, opening their minds and giving them eyes to see, but he also accompanied it by these dramatic supernatural manifestations, akin to what happened at Pentecost. And interestingly, it replicates what happened at Pentecost. Now, why? You know, why not new signs? What, I mean, anything dramatic would do. Why the same things that happened at Pentecost? I think ultimately we find out why when we get to Acts 15. Because in Acts 15, and we'll talk about this in a future program, when we get to Acts 15, there's a controversy that develops among the early Jewish believers. And that is, they have to sort out, can Gentiles be children of God just like us? It's not obvious to them that they can, because so much of the Old Testament is directed to Jews as Jews. And it's very understandable that they came to that they formed the impression that only Jews, that salvation is for the Jews and only the Jews. And that if a Gentile wants in on this salvation, they can have it, but they get it by becoming Jews, and then as Jews can receive salvation. And that was their kind of prevailing understanding among these early Christian, these early believing Jews.
Let's talk about that in the future. Really get into it.
Yeah. But just briefly, the argument that won the day when they debated that issue in Acts 15 was Peter and Paul and Barnabas and all of these Jewish apostles who had taken the gospel to Gentiles had witnessed Gentiles receiving the Spirit in the same way they had it the day of Pentecost, accompanied by the same dramatic signs, the speaking in tongues and so on.
So what you're saying is that the signs that were similar, the same signs that were given at Pentecost and then were given later to the Gentiles, validated Gentiles as true believers.
Exactly. Gentiles and also Samaritans. Samaritans were also received the Spirit in the same way when they became believers. Samaritans were hated by the Jews. I mean, there's a tremendous hostility towards Samaritans. So God felt the same, God saw that, accomplished the same thing with respect to the Samaritans. You think that these Samaritans are unworthy of me. I'm telling you, if they believe, I accept them as children of God just like you. And how do you know that? I'm giving them the Spirit, the same as I did to you.
Okay, so he was putting them all on the same equal playing field.
Yep.
And demonstrating that by these miraculous signs that were exactly the same thing for each of them. There was the roaring wind, there were the flames of fire, and there were tongues.
Yeah, or at least the tongues. It's not always clear whether all of the signs accompany them, but at least the speaking in tongues are explicitly mentioned on some occasions. Right. But he uses just the little formula, they received the Spirit, and it's hard to know how much of that content we're to put into that. But enough so that they recognize that the same thing is happening to them that happened to us. And that settles the issue.
It just authenticated everybody as being possible believers.
Exactly.
Nobody's left out.
Yeah. Because in effect, the conclusion that the apostles come to in Acts 15 is, if God has said, yes, they are my children, who are we to say, no, they're not? Yeah, who are we to go against God? God has already said they're our children. There's nothing to argue with. Very dramatic moment and a very crucial moment in the book of Acts. And God has set them up for that. God has retrained their thinking by means of these supernatural signs. So why does it get replicated? Because God is having the apostles develop some greater clarity in their thinking about what this is all about. He's giving them the revelation that they need so that they can come to the right conclusion, grasp the truth of what God is doing in the world. He's calling out for himself a people from among the Gentiles who don't have to be Jews to be his children. And that becomes clear to them in time.
Okay, your argument about receiving the Spirit during that time was God poured out his Spirit in a very new and different way than he ever had in history on the day of Pentecost. After that, he also poured out his Spirit in terms of these special signs to Samaritans, Gentiles, and Jews in order to authenticate them all as believers on an equal playing field, telling us in no uncertain terms we all have access to God. Now, today, when we talk about being filled with the Spirit, what I'm hearing you say is, wow, that was a point in time, and it's not necessarily for now. Having the Spirit poured on my life then doesn't have to be authenticated by those signs, by the supernatural signs. The signs that need to be seen in my life are the kind of heart that I have toward God that demonstrates itself in the way I relate to other people, in the kind of wisdom I have, in a true pursuit of God, which takes courage, which takes risk, which challenges and changes my thinking and my actions.
Right, exactly. Very well said. To receive the Spirit, to be walking according to the Spirit, to be living in the Spirit, and perhaps even to be filled with the Spirit, although as we talked about in the last program, filled with the Spirit may be reserved for moments of unusual clarity and unusual wisdom, but nevertheless, they all come to the same thing. The activity of the Spirit is to do exactly what you said. And if I want to know whether I have received the Spirit, then I need to watch my life. What does my life look like? Does it look like a life in pursuit of wisdom? Then there's no other explanation for that except that the Spirit of God has come and is working in my life.
And I think I need to watch my life, not in terms of how people see me generally on the outside, perhaps at my work or friends that I see sometimes or whatever. I think I need to look at my life in light of what my husband or my wife or my children might say about my life, because that's really where it comes out. Or, of course, if I'm not married, to look at my life relative to the places where I'm most intimately connected to people. It is so easy, Jack, to be deceived by what I want other people to see and by my ability to put that across, unless I'm really in a challenging life-on-life rubbing situation. I don't think things really come out.
Right, yeah. You're probably saying both of these things, but it's easy to be deceived by others, are you talking about? When they glue the plastic fruit of the Spirit on the outside of their life, and I look at that and I go, oh, wow, they're amazingly spiritual.
Oh, yeah, but I was speaking, that's very true, but I'm more speaking of myself here.
Self-deception, okay.
Right. It's so easy for me to think maybe I have it pretty well anchored, and you know, I just have a husband and wife that if they would change, I would then be, you know, pretty okay. And I think that's not true. I think I need to really look at where my life is hitting most closely to other people. Yeah. And that's where the true Christine is made manifest.
Yeah, that's a profoundly important point. We spend so much time deceiving other people, having them feed back how spiritual I am, and then take that as evidence of how spiritual I am.
That's exactly the root.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of scary.
Yeah.
And I think we really have to be honest with ourselves. I think it's much more difficult for somebody who is not in a marriage relationship, because you're not rubbing, you know, life on life, and it's not as easy for that to happen, that hard thing to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think self-deception is just really, really there. And I think if we use an outward standard like I can speak in tongues as a standard of my spirituality or a standard of me being a person that's filled with the Spirit, I think that, like you said in the beginning, we have taken it to a very superficial level.
Right.
A dangerous level, even.
Right.
Now, I am not at all convinced that the Spirit doesn't come and allow people to speak in tongues. I think that's quite possible. It's not, honestly, a big part of what I see in the context of my life or the churches that I'm in, but I don't want to throw it out. I do think, though, it's easy to speak in tongues by comparison to be kind to my husband when I've been married for 20 years and the things he does really impact my life in a way that's very, very uncomfortable, maybe humiliating, maybe painful to me. And to love that person and to show kindness to that person and to keep being a vulnerable, open, gentle, compassionate, forgiving woman in the midst of that is far more difficult than speaking in tongues.
Right. Exactly.
There's no comparison.
That brings us back to your original question about why is it that we make speaking in tongues the mark of spirituality and not the mighty roaring wind and the flames of fire? I think the answer ultimately is because speaking in tongues we can counterfeit. Speaking in tongues is something that we can kind of patch onto our lives in order to attempt to replicate spirituality. It doesn't ultimately have to be of the Spirit. It doesn't ultimately have to be authentic. It doesn't ultimately have to be from God. And that's an unfortunate reality, but I think it's all too true that I can't replicate the flaming fires over my head. I mean, either God puts them there or they're not there. I can't replicate a mighty roaring wind. I don't have control over that. Only God does. But there is a mental ability to do glossolalia, and it may be an unusual human phenomenon, but it's not supernatural. It doesn't need to be supernatural. It doesn't need to be of the Spirit of God. And so we gravitate toward that which I can do in order to credential my own spirituality. And what's attractive about that is exactly what you have suggested. What's attractive about that is I can present myself as spiritual without having to face and acknowledge what my life with my husband or wife has revealed, what my life with my children has revealed, what my life with my neighbor has revealed.
Or has revealed, and I keep pulling the shutters on.
Right.
I don't want it to be revealed, so I keep on covering it over in lots of different ways.
Right.
But Jack, are you saying that then all tongues might be just might be contrived? It doesn't seem so to me, because certainly there are people who have gone into different countries, for example, and at least who record being able to speak a language they don't know or understand a language that they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's truly not something I can contrive. It's not something I can make up.
Well, I'm certainly not suggesting that if God did it once, he can't do it again. I mean, obviously he can do it again. And if those are accurate reports, then that's what's happening, is that God is supernaturally giving somebody the ability to speak in a language that they don't know, for practical purposes on the one hand, but also for the sign that it is that there's something remarkable about this message, the gospel that this minister is bringing to them. That's entirely possible. The argument that God can never do it again because, I don't know what the argument is, because God said so, that doesn't hold any water, it seems to me, because there's nothing clearly in the scripture that says God will never, ever, ever have somebody speak in tongues again in the same way they did at Pentecost. I think that's really a stretch to make that kind of claim. But on the other hand, when you have a theology that says it has to be, then that sets us up to misconstrue, misinterpret, exaggerate, and otherwise pass on reports that are not really accurate reports. Let me give you an example. I was once in a Bible study where somebody spoke in tongues, spoke in glossolalia. And as we were leaving the Bible study, I heard somebody say, "That sounded like Greek to me." Well, I knew Greek And I knew that it didn't resemble Greek in the least. There wasn't anything Greek about it. But this person was just making this casual comment that sounded like Greek to me. And I got to thinking, that person said to another person that sounded like Greek to me, it wouldn't be unlike us human beings when that person goes and reports that event to somebody else. I was in a Bible study last night, somebody spoke in tongues, and as we were leaving, somebody else told me that that was Greek. Well, now it's changed from that sounded like Greek to me to that was Greek. And the way the third person who's hearing that is, they assume that the person who said that was Greek knew what they were talking about and was actually giving an accurate report. And that will get slightly exaggerated the next time too. I had a friend who was at a Bible study, somebody spoke in tongues, and somebody who knew Greek recognized it as Greek. Well, that's not what happened at all, but everybody is making assumptions. They are not trying to defraud. They are not trying to lie. They are reporting back exactly what they heard. It's just that what they heard was not exactly what the person speaking intended, reporting intended, and sooner or later, you have this full-blown miracle being reported when, in fact, what happened was very unclear what was going on there. And I think we must not underestimate that when we hear these reports of miracles from overseas and so on and so forth, is the report coming to me exactly what happened, or has there been a kind of transformation of the story to make it sound clearer and less ambiguous than in fact it was? So I don't take any of those reports at exactly face value is what I'm saying for that reason.
I think the attitude that, I mean, obviously from what we're saying, we're people that have not gravitated towards speaking in tongues and seeing that as something that's important in our lives as believers, or even see God working in that way in this age. I think that's probably even more true for you than it is for me. I think you've studied it longer and you have a much stronger picture of it than I do. But I think where I'm left with is there could be people listening and being very angry at this broadcast and saying, hey, we're really going against what's important to them. And what I would say, and I'm quite certain that you would say it, is that it really, bottom line, doesn't matter that much to me. If that's their way of expressing, if they really believe in that, expressing their relationship to God, and that's something that has become important to them, and it truly is from the heart, a way that they want to love God, then that's a good thing.
Sure.
I don't care what it is. If brushing my teeth becomes a way to love God or anything, then it is the heart of the believer that becomes very important. And so I don't have an argument with them. I don't have a problem with it. Now, I do have a problem with it if it's something that they use to deceive themselves and to deceive other people and there's no heart at all. I have a problem with it because I'm scared for their salvation and for the people that they're influencing.
Right.
And that's a big concern. But it's not necessarily what's happening. What might be happening is this person really wanting to pursue God, and that's the way it looks to them.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly my attitude. If speaking in tongues is the way in which God is teaching me to love Him and pursue wisdom, I'm exactly doing where God wants me. If it eclipses my pursuit of wisdom and my love of God, then it's a temptation that could destroy me. And each person has to answer that for himself or herself. But yeah, I don't have any problem with it. If it's the way God is leading people to Himself, then that's fine. Because that's the bottom line. That's what makes us a child of God.
That's what we want, and that's what we need to look at.
Yeah.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, Mackenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant, a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The Mackenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible.
Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited, and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at McKenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter News and Views are also available. Information about how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
We're coming to the end of this program. We are going to go off the air at the end of March. Some of you on your radio stations will hear the last program Friday or Saturday of March, and some of you Sunday, April 1st. But we're quickly coming to an end of this program. Christine and I want to take this opportunity to thank you for your participation, for being the audience that you've been, the letters that you've sent. Some of you have sent money to support this program, and we just want to take this opportunity to tell you how much we truly have appreciated interacting with you, getting to know some of you, corresponding with some of you, and being supported by you. It wouldn't have been possible without your encouragement. You sent letters explaining how much we have meant to you, and that's what kept us going, that knowledge that somebody was benefiting by what we were doing. So we want to take this last opportunity to just thank you for that.
I just so much want to echo that. I so thoroughly have appreciated people's letters that were so often written from their hearts. Sometimes there were criticisms and encouragements to do things differently, and sometimes there were just people who turned on the channel and a lights came on in their life. And we got a lot of those letters where it was kind of amazing, Jack, that there were people, even in prisons, who our voices went to, and they heard and responded. And we are so appreciative to you guys and to God for giving us the opportunity to speak to you in ways that, about things that have meant so much to us. It is a privilege to have done that for you. Thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.